Going Linux, episode 454, listener feedback.
No viruses, no fuss, just simple and clean. Going Linux, it's the ultimate dream. Forget the crashes and the constant lag with open source. You're never gonna sag.
Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill.
Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and open source applications and using them to get things done.
If you want to send us feedback, you can email us at goinglinux@gmail.com. Or you can send us a voicemail at 1-904-468-7889.
In today's episode, listener feedback.
Hello, Bill. How are things?
Hi, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing well. I hear you had a little adventure.
I did. I went to the Very Large Array, or VLA, in New Mexico. Met some really awesome people there.
Well, you have to, via a very large array of what?
Radio antennas, radio telescopes.
Okay.
Big dishes.
Looking at the stars.
Looking at the stars. You taking them radio waves and looking and see what's going on in the world.
Okay.
They are in our galaxy. Very, very interesting stuff.
So interesting. We've spent the last hour talking about it, looking at pictures, looking at articles on the web. Yeah, yeah.
We talked about it so you wouldn't have to.
But we'll include some links.
Yeah. Basically, it's a really, really neat place to learn about why radio telescopes are so important. It is also the supercomputer, you know, that they takes all that data and correlates it, is running Red Hat 7, and they're getting ready to go to Red Hat 8. Of course they're running Linux.
Of course.
And of course I was going to ask them what they're running. They use a lot of open source software, and we won't go into all the specifics, but maybe on a future episode we can discuss. But one of the cool things, if anybody wants to see how is open source is being used, there's a program called APES, and it's spelled AIPS. It's licensed under the GNU version 2, and I actually spoke to the developer, the guy that actually wrote it, works at the VLA. His name's Eric Greason. Nice guy. Uh-huh. Super nice guy. But he wrote the software back when it in Fortran and wrote the first one where it would run on a VAC 20. And I mean, he's old school. And he was describing why it was licensed under the GNU and his whole kind of philosophy of, you know, why you should your software should be like that. And he was telling me some of the reasons behind his decisions to do it like that. And so he was really very humble. But the guy's software is what is used to actually make those pretty pictures. Mm-hmm. That everybody's like, ooh, ah, how pretty. And so his software is being used even by the James Webber telescope and stuff. So they got all these different engineers, scientists, and astronomers using his software that he had written and open sourced it.
Yeah.
For everybody's benefit. He's a fascinating guy. He's really, really an interesting guy to talk to, and he's talking to, he's just as humble, but you would never know that this guy has written basically one of biggest pieces of critical software that's being used by all these radio telescopes. So incredible person, and an older guy. Wonderful to talk to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does sound fascinating, and we'll have a link to all this stuff, including photos and a virtual tour and various other things.
Yeah.
But so if you're interested in space exploration or radio telescopes or anything along those lines, you'll want to check on those. We'll have three separate links, one for VLA, one for the APES software, and one for Eric Greason himself. So
One of the young astronomers was telling me that APES, you know, he apparently has a sense of humor, so the handbook on how to use it and everything has a bunch of banana jokes in it and stuff like that.
That's cool.
Yeah. So he's a really fun guy to talk to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you just realize how smart some of these people are, because when we were talking and he was describing some of the stuff, I got about 50% of what he was talking about, and I just realized that this guy's probably forgotten more than I will ever know, and he was dumbing it down for me. That's like, thank you.
It's cool that you got to see it. It's cool that you got to talk to him, and it's cool that they're running Linux.
Yeah, and they wouldn't let me play with their supercomputer, Larry. Can you believe that?
Aww.
I wanted to. I'd say, well,
I know.
They wouldn't even let me in the building.
Oh, my.
They're like, I'm sorry. You can't be in here. It was all fun. It was a great time.
Yeah.
I highly recommend anybody get a chance to go. Oh, one final note just for our listeners. Now, since their supercomputer is called WIDAR, it's because it's very specialized in what it does. It's technically not a general purpose computer. So when you hear these lists of how the world's fastest supercomputers, it's on the list, but it's only because it's so fast, but it's also because it just does one thing. It takes all that data and then correlates it and then ships it on. So it's very specialized. But he was telling me that the supercomputer is right now still 60th fastest supercomputer in the world. Now, it used to be one of the fastest. And this was back in, using like early to mid 2000s hardware. So, it's not even the newest hardware, but it's still on listed like the 60th fastest. So it's pretty cool. It's like, and we run Linux on it. Good for you.
Yep. It's still in the top 100 even after all that time.
So yeah,
it's
still in the top 100.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty cool. And their next version's even going to be more powerful, so they'll be right back. But it's been running for a while. We were talking. Just to give you one last idea of how good this thing is what it was. 16 quadrillion calculations a second it was doing. I think it was what it was.
Is that all?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I don't know what the problem is. Our home computers would just go poof and stop.
Yeah, exactly. They'd burn right up. They must have a big hard drive.
Most of this, from what they were telling me, all of this raw data is not written to disk. It's done in real time in memory before it's shipped. Mm. Before it's shipped on.
How much RAM does this thing have? Holy mackerel.
Each one of these radio telescopes can generate one. It might not sound like a lot, but if you think about it, right now you got 27 running. 1 gigabyte of data a second.
Wow.
1 gigabyte.
That's faster than my little laptop.
Your little laptop would go, what? But no, one gigabyte a second.
That's amazing.
Over fiber optics, because they have two.
Of course.
They have 2,700 feet of fiber optics through this whole thing. So when they run this, these dishes way out in the middle, because they can move the dishes, you know, they're all connected fiber optics. So it's sending all this data just full bore to this supercomputer. All it does is just all these calculations nonstop, 24/7.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that cool?
Wow. Yes, it certainly is. And we better stop talking about it or we'll go on for another hour.
But it's so cool. Okay.
I know it is. This is not the Very Large Array podcast, although there should be one of those. Yeah, that's for sure.
Those guys are awesome. And open source in Linux, perfect day. Okay.
Yep, you bet.
So...
Okay, well, let's get started with our emails, shall we? And you take the first one.
All right, since you insist, I could talk about the very large array of into Linux.
No, you know, before we do that, I do have two questions that you can answer.
Sure.
One, Zorin giveaway, did we ever get anywhere on that?
If I told you yes, I'd be lying. I forgot to look at me.
Okay, well, you've been busy. You've been busy traveling to the middle of nowhere to visit a radio telescope and watch it move around. Okay, we'll just put that on a pin in that until we get more information on it. And then we've got some people. I don't know whether we have an email on this or not, but we've got some people that are interested in Nix. And what's going on with your Nix computer?
Nix computer, if anything. Nix computer is over here, not really doing anything. I haven't really messed with it. I have been playing with Arch Linux pretty much nonstop. And yes, I'm still running Arch. I should probably fire it up and do some stuff with it, but it's
yeah.
But I've been
you got people all excited that you were going to do some experimentation with Nix.
And oh, then I have
got,
been
kind of but sidetracked,
but I got sidetracked with very large arrays and Arch Linux. I
yeah,
mean, I've only
okay.
Man, I gotta eat and work sometime.
Ah, jeez. Okay,
but yeah, Nix is still on my computer. I'm probably play with it a little bit later today. But yeah, it's fascinating. I think I kind of told you that. I like, you know, the declarative nature of it. But if you're going to be changing your system a lot by adding stuff, the way I've been doing it, you go in, you have to add it to config and then do a Nix rebuild. And it's okay. If I want to add Shotwell or I want to add something, it's not the most efficient, but it's okay. I mean, if that's your thing, but I don't want to have to rebuild just because I want to add a software package. If I wanted to like put apes on it, I would have to go put apes, then do a rebuild the whole thing, and then boot into the new generation. Because each one, every time you change it, it generates a new generation. But like I said, it's very cool. But I don't know if it's a good daily driver for just a normal person. That if you don't change it too much or whatever, I think it would be fine.
Sounds to me like it'd be perfect for a server where you want everything to be stable and not change, and you're not adding software every other day or anything like that. You just want it to establish the configuration, set it, and forget it.
Well, actually, I think it would be a better if you like, for instance, you had 30 school computers. And you wanted them all to run the same thing. So no matter what they did to it, you knew at the end of the day that you could reboot it, and hit the current generation, and it'll be back just like it was in the morning. So if you wanted to make sure everybody had the exact same software and it was reproducible, then I think that would be the way to go. It's like you really can't mess it up. Because I can always roll back to current good configuration, and everybody has the same stuff.
Yeah, I know we have at least one listener who is here in California who is doing just that, not necessarily with Nix unless he's switched over, but I can see that as a really good application for it.
Or
sounds good.
Or the last one is if you have a computer that you need to set up for like your older parents and you don't want them to be able to, change things or break things. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You could just say, here it is, and if something happens, just restart it and, click that to current configuration file, the startup menu, and it's right back. No harm, no foul. So
yeah, it sounds good.
Yeah, so yeah. It's
instant recovery.
Yeah, instant recovery. And so I could see that, especially if you're doing it from distance. So it has its uses, and I think it has a lot more uses. It's a fascinating way of looking at stuff. But I'll let you know as I play with it more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sounds good. Okay, well, let's get into our email.
Okay. So our email comes from Robert, who asked about Linux headers. Okay. Really, really enjoyed the show last week about all the distros and various tips and information. Thank you. I have another new question. What are Linux headers that my update manager on Linux Mint asked me to confirm I want to change when there's a kernel update? As another statistic, I have tried Manjaro, Ubuntu, Pop, and OpenSUSE, which I have failed to install as the installer was so confusing to me because I had the wrong version. Hey, it happens.
Okay. Yep.
But I keep going back to Linux Mint. It's not the flashiest or the leanest, but like you guys say, just lets me get things done. Thank you again. Look forward to the next show, Robert. Okay. So he's asking about the headers. So I guess when you change the kernel or there's a kernel update, it has to update. I don't know exactly what the headers actually do. I know they're part of the kernel. Do you know? I'm drawing a blank here.
Yeah, I had to do a little bit of research on this myself because I had this vague notion of what they were, but essentially what the research boils down to is when you update the kernel, as occasionally software updaters going to want you to do, the headers are used to tell the installed programs and apps where to find the new kernel. And without those, your system will use only the old kernel unless you delete it. And if you delete it before updating those headers, I'm thinking that might cause a little bit of trouble.
Breakage?
So, exactly. So you do want to, after the system updates the kernel, you do want to update the headers as well. And on my system, at least, it does require a reboot in between those two. And that's the only time installing software on Linux has required a reboot, in my experience.
If I remember correctly, actually, I think I'm right on this. So when you update the kernel, until you reboot it, you're still running on the old kernel, so you could have already...
Exactly
you,
right.
You could install the new kernel, update all the headers, but until you reboot it with the new headers, I guess, instruction on how to use the kernel, the new kernel, you're going to be basically on the old. That's why you have to restart so it can move the old one out and put the new one in. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I've noticed that there was a warning at least one time when I had a Linux kernel update. It says, do you want to delete all the old kernels? Or do you want to delete all the old kernels except for the one you're currently using? Which is probably a good idea. You don't want to delete the kernel while you're using it. But the updating the headers... The kernel headers is very important.
Yeah.
And the other part of his question was about Linux Mint and as we've said many, many times, it's a great choice for getting started with Linux. We recommend it all the time. And Robert, please let us know what happens with your Linux adventures, whether you stick with Mint or whether you go on to something new.
And Robert, just between me and you, so no one else is listening, it's okay to distro hop. I might have done a little bit of that. Just a little bit. But Manjaro was I was kind of want to know which version of Manjaro did you use. If you like the Cinnamon Desktop, I guess that's what you're running, because that seems to be, they say about 75% of people run the Cinnamon. There's also
On Linux Mint, that is.
There's, if you like the Cinnamon Desktop, Manjaro has one. Ubuntu, do you remember what that one's called?
There's Ubuntu Cinnamon.
Ubuntu Cinnamon. Pop uses their, doesn't have a Cinnamon derivative that I know of, and I don't think OpenSUSE does.
Don't know about OpenSUSE.
OpenSUSE.
He had the wrong version of that one anyway.
Yeah. So. OpenSUSE is a little temperamental, and it's not the easiest install. So believe me, I don't even like installing it, because I think the installer needs to be rewritten to be a little more user friendly. But you know, that's just me. Please, if you run OpenSUSE and love it, don't flame me. I'm just making an opinion. But yeah, sounds like you've been trying them all. So if you like Linux Mint, stay with it. If you wanted to try some other stuff, you can try the Ubuntu Cinnamon. Or is that right? Ubuntu Cinnamon,
yep. Gary? Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And because I run Cinnamon on my Arch system, so I like, I think Cinnamon's a great desktop, and
I do too. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so Robert, let us know how it goes, and if you change or you have any other questions, let us know.
Okay. Our next email is from Stefan, who writes, "No listener feedback." He says, "Hello, Bill. I just visited New Mexico a few days ago, and I heard in an episode that you are located somewhere in New Mexico. Where are you located? I visited Santa Fe, Alamogordo, and Carlsbad. Best regards, Stefan."
Stefan, welcome to New Mexico. So, yes, I do live in New Mexico. I'm in the Albuquerque area. I live about 27 miles right outside of Albuquerque in a little small town called Moriarty, New Mexico. And so, yeah, I work in Albuquerque and live just outside, away from all the craziness that is the city. Santa Fe was really cool. I'm glad. I wonder how you liked it. Alamogordo, I haven't been there, and believe it or not, I haven't been to Carlsbad, but I hear it's really cool. But I have been to VLA. Sorry.
Yes, there you go. Throw that in there.
Stefan, New Mexico. I'd be interested to see what you thought of it. It's desert, so you know, I don't know where you're originally from, but write us back and let us know how you like New Mexico. And if you get a chance, you always have to visit Albuquerque, or as we call it, Albuquerque. But I hope you enjoyed your time here.
Yeah, and thanks for the non-listener feedback.
That's so cool. So our next one comes from Donald, and he's a new listener. Well, hey, Donald. He said, "Hi, guys. Thanks for the great show. Any advice on hardening techniques for Linux users? I currently use Linux Mint as my daily. I have multiple reasons for using Mint. Regards, Donald." So hardening techniques. Okay.
Well, let's see. You could turn on a firewall.
Uh-huh.
That would make things a little more secure. There's a firewall usually comes with.
I think it's already turned on.
Yeah, in you can adjust the settings for the firewall. And Linux Mint, I think, is one of those where it's installed by default, but not turned on by default. So you might want to check that. It can cause some problems with your access to certain websites, but you can adjust it. So just be careful with that. Or if it wasn't disabled to begin with, disable it. But if you're trying to harden your system, that would be one way to do it. And, you know, you could use all kinds of security software. You could look for security software for Linux. But for the most part, it's pretty secure to begin with, especially if you have the firewall turned on. So that's my little piece of advice. Very little.
Here's
how about you?
Yeah, here's mine. Make sure your firewall's on. Make sure that you are running and have installed the latest updates, especially the security updates.
Yes.
You can set your settings to automatically install security updates on Linux Mint, I believe. You'll want to pull from the repositories. Don't use Flatpaks unless you absolutely have to, or don't use Snaps, don't use AppIm. Just try to use as many of the native repository packages. Since it's Ubuntu based, they have access to all the repositories. That I think is what 88,000 packages. So you should probably find what you want, but you're going to want to make sure that you are not downloading Flatpaks or Snaps that are unverified. And right now they seem to be having some issues with those packages formats. So I'm not saying that it's bad. It's just they have some things they need to address and some security vulnerabilities. So I would suggest staying away from them for a little while until they get them sorted, because you're going to want to make sure that you have, good packages. So just use official repos. I would also say make sure you have a strong password. And also, I believe Linux Mint offers the ability to encrypt your home folder when you do the install. So make sure that's turned on. So those are all easy ways to make sure that it's installed. You have your updates. You have your home partition encrypted. You make sure that you stay current on security. You're not using third party package formats, and I think that will go a long way. Good passwords, I think there's also ability to download. I think Brave is the one that's is privacy oriented, and it has some security settings. You can also go into Firefox, and it also has ability to turn things off and make it more secure. And they also have some security extensions that you can download that they recommend. So I think if you do that, and I think you'll be pretty good. I can't think of anything else that, I don't think that you need much more than that.
Yeah, that's a pretty exhaustive list, I think, and all of that is good advice.
Yeah.
If you do nothing more than one of those things, the most important thing, in my opinion, is to keep up with the software updates. Linux is really good, no matter which the distribution, Linux generally is very good about ensuring that security vulnerabilities and other updates are done frequently. To fix any issues, whether it's an attack or whether it's some other vulnerability, Linux usually gets on it at least as quickly as or more quickly than Windows or Mac. And if you just stay up to date on all of the operating system updates and application updates, you'll be doing 90% of the work right there. So if you only have one of those things you want to do, stay up to date on your updates is my advice.
I agree.
Okay. All right, let's move on then. Our next email is from Philip, who says his wife runs her business on Pop OS. Hi, Bill and Larry. I love the show. I recently had a humbling experience with my wife. She has never used anything but Windows, and I have been using nothing but Linux for the past few years. And I have to admit, doing some bragging about it to my wife and telling her about how much fun it was to mess with. I would explain things to her until her eyes began to glaze over and slightly roll back in her head. That was when I knew it was time for a brief intermission. When she started her own small business and needed a computer to help manage it, I gave her one of my laptops with Pop OS on it. I told her I could install Windows on it if she wanted. To my surprise, she said she would try Linux. I hovered around her for a while waiting for her many questions on how to run such a difficult operating system. What a great bonding experience this would be, the master helping the new student. I stood there with my hands folded behind my back, waiting patiently as she expertly clicked and clicked away with her fingers flying. Every once in a while, I would say something like, "Opening new programs is a little bit different than Windows. You just have to go, oh, you have already found it." So she did ask me one question. She turned to me and asked, "Why is this so hard?" Well, I guess I'll have to impress my wife in other ways. I should have never married someone who is so much smarter than me. Until next time, Subminion Phil from Iowa. P.S. Do you think she would be impressed if I installed Gentoo? Well, Philip, I don't know about that, but yeah, great story. Great story.
That's hilarious. So, Philip, maybe just think about it. You should ask your wife for her help because, as you said, you married someone smarter than you, and that's always a good thing. Yeah. Marrying someone smarter than you is not a bad thing. But hey, just look at her and just say, "Honey, could you tell me how to do this?" And watch her help you with your Linux. That would be awesome. But as far as the Gentoo, she probably would do it faster than you. So I would just impress her with some other ways because it sounds like you've got a tech-savvy wife. Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah, it is, for sure.
Oh, thanks for sharing that, Phil. That's great. So our next email comes from David, and he provides feedback on episode 452. "Great show, guys, as always. I love my Zorin laptop. It has been a great Chromebook replacement. However, it's not my daily driver. I hate Windows and finally ditched it. I tried hard to find the programs I needed on Linux and gave up and have gone all Apple, an M2 MacBook Air, and from wife an M2 Mac Mini. While true that I can use MS Office via web on Linux, that is not as good as native on the desktop. I tried Wine and Crossover for Linux to run Excel, just didn't work well. When Linux finally runs MS Office natively, I will gladly ditch Apple, but until then, yes, I have tried all the alternatives to Excel, and they're all inferior. On this show, you gave Linux a grade of A, Apple a grade of B, and Windows a grade of C." He said, "I love your sense of humor. To me, everyone has an opinion, along with a rear end. I would give Mac a grade of A, Linux a grade of B+, and Windows a grade of C-. Okay. Apple gets the minus due to price, but at least mainstream programs like Intuit, TurboTax, MS Office, Fidelity, Active Trader Pro, etc. all work on the Mac. Good luck with Linux on these. Linux gets a B+, even though it's probably the best operating system, but one has to jump through too many hoops to run best practices commercial and private software with it. Windows gets a C- because I am feeling generous and not hating on the registry too much today. Glad I finally kicked it to the curb. Otherwise, enjoying the show. Keep up the good work. David, retired CPA and loving retirement. No Oracle, no Microsoft, etc., etc.
Yeah. Well, I understand if you're trying to do a lot of financial stuff. There are some financial programs that will run on Linux, but I agree. In my experience, and I have to admit it's fairly limited, but even with that limited experience, I can tell that some of the financial software you need for doing some of the work that I suspect you're still doing, even though you're retired, it's going to be a challenge getting that on Linux. And a Mac is probably your best choice, quite frankly. It'll run the software you need, and it's going to give you much less hassle than Windows, for sure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can see that most of his stuff is, financial. So, yeah. So just so you know, we always say, hey, use what works for you. We're not, and we pick on Microsoft because they're so easy to pick on. And
it's true. That's true.
Okay. But, if you need to run a Mac to get your stuff that you need to get done, we're all about getting it done. We're just happy you tried Linux and you liked it. We'll use what we need to. Like, both of us have iPhones. Just because I don't like Android, and I like the way the iPhone is. I'll use what helps me get my work done or what I need to get done. Will I always choose Linux? Yeah, I'll choose Linux. If I can find a way to use Linux for everything, I would. But we live in a world where it's not perfect. So we just kind of have to be a little bit flexible, but I'm glad it's working out. And hey, don't give up on Linux. There's other things you can do. You can use that your Mac for your all your CPA stuff, and then you can boot up Linux and use it for everything else. See?
Problem solved. Sure. Yeah. Use dual boot on that Mac.
But congratulations on retirement. That sounds fun.
I'm sure it is. Anyway. Okay, well, again, thanks very much, David, for that. Our next email is from Martin, who wrote, "Hi, Larry and Bill. I'm a listener from the Netherlands. I like your podcast for the informative content and the humor you bring with it. There are several trends going on I really like to follow, NixOS and AI. I'm looking forward to hearing more about Bill's experiences with NixOS." Yeah. As far as AI is concerned, I came across TLM, which is really nice. TLM is a terminal command line copilot. You can ask it questions in normal language, and then it will suggest a command for you. It can also explain commands you come across. It might be very useful for the less experienced user who is searching for the right commands in the terminal. It works offline as well. And he provides a link to that TLM software. And we'll have that in the show notes, of course. Keep up the show. I'm always looking forward to the next episode. Martin.
I'll let you know how my next stuff goes.
And TLM, I'm going to have to give that a try.
I'll have to read more before I put anything like that on my system. Because I want to see what the developer, who the developer is, and what kind of permissions that you need to grant this thing before I put anything.
Yeah.
But that's me just being cautious, especially since all the, the last XZ and all the problems with the snaps and the flat packs as recently, I'm just like, need to just
just be a little more cautious.
Yeah, I'm a little more cautious. But yeah, Larry, I'll let you do that one.
Okay, well, when I say I've got to try it, that means I'm putting it into a virtual machine and giving it a try there.
Yeah, okay.
So, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, Yeah, Larry is the smart one of the crew. I'm one of those people that just will throw it on the bare metal. No, Larry's a little smarter than I am when it comes to testing stuff. It's like,
I don't know about smarter, but I'm certainly cautious, that's for sure.
So we'll let you know. But yes, Martin, I'll let you know how the Nix goes on. Like I said, I've used it. I've been enjoying it. I just haven't been using it a lot lately. I've been kind of busy. But I
will hear more about it, I'm sure, Martin.
Yeah. So our next one comes from David, who is followed up on XZ Utils. I am now noticing many other articles. The technical ones are about the effect of SSH sounds very concerning. For example, and he lists an Ars Technica, the link in the show notes. Fortunately, according to that, I've read the hack did not reach the wild, but got awfully close. Nevertheless, it shows a vulnerability in open source methodology. I think that's how you say it. So, David, I'm going to agree to disagree. Because it's open source, that was one of the reasons we found it. If it was a closed source project, we would have probably never found it, or would never known that it had been found. Yes, we do have some weak areas in our open source development, and I'll name them right here. We work our project developers way too hard. We expect a lot for volunteers. A lot of these guys work full-time jobs, and it's just a passion project that they maintain. The guy that was doing the XZ utils, you know, he was he's burnt out. This is how and why it happened. You know, he developed, maintained a utility used by all these distributions, and he just got burnt out and got taken advantage of. We need to find a way to compensate our open source developers and the people that maintain our projects. We need, you know, we get a lot of work that these people never get anything for. We need to change that. We need to change the you know, how we handle that. But without open source, a lot of stuff that you use wouldn't be available. You couldn't afford it. Blender, LibreOffice, I mean, all these other projects that are maintained or open source or maintained by foundations or individuals. So, yes, we have some points that we need to work on, but I think overall, because we have open source and people giving their time and looking at the code, and we can look at the code and see what's going on, I think we're much better than a closed source proprietary software. I don't know how you feel about it, Larry, but that's my, I'm so tired of people saying, oh, see, open source is garbage, or open source isn't reliable. I'm not saying David said that, but I'm just saying I've heard that. It's not as good. I don't agree. Think about what we get for absolutely nothing.
Yeah, you said it very well, Bill. And the thing that irks me about people bashing on open source is the press, at least the American press, implies in some of its reporting on security breaches and so on that open source software is inferior or is in some way responsible for the breach. And that is just not true. And I chalk that up to a lack of understanding on the part of the reporters, if not the writers. And it's just be careful what you listen to, which is good advice in any case, regardless of what the topic is. But just be careful, check the source, and check the open source.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Kind of passionate about this subject because I've been following the story and I've been hearing about this. But if this had happened in Microsoft Windows, we would either never found it, or if they did find it, we'd never know that it was there, or it still might be running there. So because it's closed source. We can't see what's actually doing and what what kind of data is being accessed. You know, they're not required to let us look at source code. Being able to see how something's put together is very important, especially when you're running software and you want to make sure that it's doing what it's supposed to and nothing else. And that's, this is not something new. This has happened multiple times that they find stuff in commercial software that's been there for years that was never found until someone happens to, someone gets affected by something negative. So as far as me, I feel much more secure and much more confident in the software that's running on open source, where the software is freely auditable. I mean, you can actually look and audit that code if you want. So I'll stay with open source anytime I get a chance.
Anyway, okay.
Sorry. That's a hot button topic for me. It's like, I'm so tired of hearing that.
Yes. Well, we will end our podcast on that rant. And,
I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah. So we will have not another listener feedback episode right away, but some other topic, which we are still preparing. And until then, you can go to our website at goinglinux.com for articles and show notes, as well as links to download and subscribe. We provide the website for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done.
And if you like, you can participate directly with our friendly and helpful community members by joining the discussion in our Going Linux podcast community on community.goinglinux.com.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Our new theme music is made with Suno AI at suno.com. That's SUNO.com.